Today's guest says that her journey towards a sense of self began the moment her mother died. We'll find out more about that in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I am pleased to introduce to you Cheryl Rice, who is the founder of Your Voice, Your Vision, and author of Where Have I Been All My Life. Cheryl, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Cheryl, you begin your book talking about your experience of taking care of your mom during the last months of her life. And you describe yourself as the self-appointed quarterback of her care team. Talk a little bit more about that.
So my mom was diagnosed very abruptly with stage 4 lung cancer, and we were all taken aback. She had been an otherwise healthy, vibrant 67-year-old woman living the golden years of her life when we got the diagnosis. And as I'm sure many of your listeners know, when something like that happens, everything changes on a dime. And one of my commitments in that moment was to make sure that I was being as much of an advocate for her as I could throughout the healthcare system, as well as, of course, a very attentive daughter. And so my father, who was still very much alive and very much a part of this, was so devastated by this diagnosis himself. I felt like I really needed to be the one to stand up and make sure we were getting all the information. I was taking notes, asking the tough questions of doctors so that my mom could focus on understanding what was happening to her and of course, going through the treatment. So that's what I meant by being the quarterback, really just helping to take the lead on all the myriad of details that happen as soon as you're faced with a diagnosis like that.
So it sounds like you were parenting both of your parents almost.
Certainly. And you know, this is not unusual as parents age and children age. I was in my 40s at the time. So I felt it as a privilege, to be quite honest with you, Pamela. It was not a burden. There was no other role I would have wanted. I wanted to be there for them in any way I could. And certainly this was one way.
And your mother ultimately passed. And what was that like for you in that moment?
Well, in that moment, it was breathtaking. I thought I had been prepared for it. We knew she was no longer responding to treatment. She had about 4.5 months of treatment before we decided, or we were told, it wasn't working. And so then there were a few weeks in between the end of treatment and her death. And it was something that ultimately I could not have been prepared for, and we just did everything we could to keep her comfortable and to make sure everything that needed to be said was said and that she had a peaceful passing and she was surrounded by those who loved her. But it was truly startling. I found myself at her bedside trying to keep pace with her breaths, and her breath would become more labored, and I had this moment where I couldn't hold my breath, and I had to breathe on my own. And I think that was a sign of things to come, that I could not breathe for her, and nor she for me. And I had to stay alive. And so I was at her bedside, and so was my father and my aunt. And I really believed she waited until my father, who had been coming from a different location, she waited until he was there. And as soon as he came by her bedside, he gave her a kiss, and she passed.
That's an extraordinary, almost chilling visual to think about, both for you, for your dad, for your aunt, for your mom. I mean, for everybody who was there at that moment.
Yes, it was incredibly powerful, and for anybody who's had that experience of being with anybody, even a pet, at that moment of passing, it is a holy moment, an incredibly moving moment. And I felt so privileged to be there, Pamela. Of course, she was there. She brought me into this world. And so for me to accompany her on her journey out of it felt incredibly right, as difficult and painful as it was. It was a privilege. It was one of her last gifts to me, was to be able to accompany her on this journey, and I feel very, very gifted by my experience, as painful as, of course, it was and became in the grief. Just being with somebody as they make that final passage is a holy experience.
A holy and humbling experience, to be sure. You talk about being there with your mom every day. What about your life outside of your mom's illness?
Well, I had the privilege of having a schedule that I had a great deal of control of. I am a leadership coach and speaker, and while I had clients that I never let go during this time, I had some discretion in when I was able to see them. What was interesting is about 3 weeks before my mother's diagnosis, we did get a brand new puppy. And that was probably the hardest challenge, was helping my puppy into the world of doggyhood and also being attentive to my mom. So I did, honestly, as many, many people know who are straddling childcare and parent care, that's a tough challenge. However, again, I'm no complaints. It was a labor of love, and I had support, and I had an understanding and supportive family around me, my husband in particular. So we made it work. That's what you do. You make it work when you're coming from a place of love and devotion.
Absolutely. You describe yourself as, during your growing up years, as having been your mother's doll. And you heard me quote you at the beginning of today's conversation, quoting you having said that your journey towards your sense of yourself did not begin until, honestly, you were no longer in the place to be able to care for your mom. But it sounds like during much of your childhood, caring for your mom was precisely what you did in one way or another.
I think that's very astute and very fair, Pamela. I think I was the firstborn, first of two. My mother was 22 when she had me. She had come to this country from South Africa. She was raised in South Africa. So she had only been in this country 18 months. She'd only been married 6 months, I believe, when she was pregnant with me. So she was in many ways a child herself, deeply homesick for her family, her home country. Her parents were not in this country at the time. My father was working full-time and then some, trying to provide for his family. So I think she was incredibly bereft in many ways and used me, and I use that word thoughtfully. She did the best she could, as all parents do, and I think she really needed me. And having me as her doll, she called me puppet, which in Afrikaans means doll, and I think she clung to me for security, and I intuited that and did all I can to be there for her, as children do. They want to please their parents, and they don't know any better, and so I think I just became exquisitely sensitive to her needs, and then later on, of course, my father's, and that's just my path. So you're absolutely right. Being a caretaker was not a novelty to me as an adult. It was something I feel in many ways I was groomed for.
You said that you developed, and now I am quoting you from Where Have I Been All My Life. You say, I developed an exquisite talent for moving away from my own feelings in order to survive, an accomplishment for which there was no reward.
Yes, absolutely right. I think I was not taught or rewarded for being tuned into my feelings, because if I had been tuned into my feelings and needs, that would have led to me wanting to advocate for them. And I don't believe I felt at that time in my life that those needs would have been met. And in fact, it felt actually quite the opposite, that my job was to make sure those around me, namely my parents, had their needs met, and I had to do whatever kind of gymnastics necessary to make sure that I was aware of their feelings and then managing the environment in such a way that their needs could be met, as much as a child can do that. But it was very clear to me that my experience was, well, it, not one that was valued. I know that might sound harsher than I mean it to. It's just that I got a lot of reward for being a caretaker of both my parents and for being very tuned into their emotional life and needs and frailties and trying to make up for them. And that's what led to a lot of the people-pleasing behaviors and my appetite for craving really approval and not learning until much later the difference between approval and love.
Cheryl, as you talk about the role, if you will, in which you were placed within your family, I'm wondering how much you know about your mom's life growing up and what her childhood was like.
I know some, and I've tried to piece more together, actually, since her passing from her sister. I know in many ways it was very, very lovely childhood. I know they moved a lot. I know that income came and went, and her father would have money and then not have money, and I think that did cause some stress. I also know she was, you know, raised during apartheid, and that had a profound effect on her and her sense of justice. She was the youngest of two. So I don't know anything that would directly speak to some of the predispositions that perhaps immersed her in parenting, the style that she had. In many ways, I think she would say she had a very good childhood in many ways. I think contrary to this, my father, on the other hand, had a very impoverished childhood in every way, and I think that had as much, if not more, of an impact on my own sense of self and needing to make up for the childhood that he lacked. His childhood was one of overt abuse and, as I said, impoverishment and horror. And we knew little about it, but enough to know that it was devastating. And I felt very early on that it was my job to somehow make up for that. And it's very interesting because my mom, as I said, was an immigrant from South Africa, and even though my father grew up in this country, I feel like he was an immigrant of sorts as well, never really having a home that had any degree of safety or consistency or love or nurturing. So that was something that was part of my inheritance that I kind of took up the mantle to try to repair, which is really just too big of a burden for a child. So much of this happens, Pamela, unconsciously and without words. Nobody said it was my job to make up for his childhood, but I felt it. And I tried valiantly, and much to my not to my advantage, let's say, ultimately.
You know, I was about to say that so often children do feel the need to take care of their parents. And you're right, it's not. Well, in some instances, it is your job to take care of me. But by and large, that is something that children experience. And it's often the parent's job to really notice what the child is doing and to disabuse the child of that notion. And that can be a challenge in and of itself.
That's so true. And I think now what I've come to learn for myself, and also even as a parent myself, how critical it is to help children to cultivate a sense of self for themselves, to actually tune into their own experience and to legitimize that for children and to teach them how to identify their feelings and that all feelings are valid and how to navigate and negotiate for one's needs and wants and desires and to really have a full range of experience, a healthy human condition that we all have. And I think now there seems to be more attention paid to that, even in movies such as, what was it? Was it Inside Out that came out a few years ago? That
yes,
really was a beautiful film from Pixar that did an awesome job of giving people, not just children, a language for honoring all of the feelings that we have and how instrumental each one is in creating a whole.
Inside Out was, you're right, a wonderful movie. I actually refer people to it very often because it was such a powerful experience and so well done.
Yeah.
One of the things that is also true is if your parents, for whatever reason, didn't learn how to make all of that, what is now almost natural wisdom for many, available, then it's hard to teach.
And that's beautiful that you said that, because I think that gets to compassion. And that's what I ultimately came to in my journey, was having a real compassion for both my parents. And for a long time, I just defended them, and I felt like they were perfect parents and perfect people. And then after my mom passed, I came to see my childhood in a different light, because I was raised with privilege. I was an upper middle class child. I had my education paid for. We had vacation, summer camp. So in many ways, my life was incredibly blessed and rich and abundant. And it was only later that I started to realize some of my predispositions, the things that I was struggling with as an adult in my marriage, for instance, came from some of the challenges that I had as a child that again, weren't visible on the outside, but emotionally were struggles I had. And once I came to see that my parents weren't human, I had to kind of work through my grief and then ultimately get to what you just highlighted so beautifully, which is compassion, that they were doing the best they could. They were young. They, again, didn't get perfectly parented themselves. And of course, that's going to have an impact. And I think for all of us, no matter what our childhood is, we all have to come to reconcile our youth and take responsibility ultimately if we want to be true adults, in my opinion. We need to make peace with what was. And compassion is a beautiful way to do that. But before the compassion, at least in my experience, Pamela, I had to first kind of feel and acknowledge the pain, some of the things that weren't so good. And that took me a while, and that was painful work for me, but I'm glad I did it.
Absolutely. Although we are talking about some of the experiences that were not present for you, there were some experiences that were very much that of a teenage girl. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd love to hear about the crush you had on Kevin, the Donny Osmond lookalike. Cheryl, what is typical of teenage girls and boys, adolescent and teenage girls and boys, is the ability to develop a crush. And you have to tell us about the crush that you had on Kevin and what you would do as a result of that crush.
So Kevin was a boy at summer camp. He was one of the maintenance staff at the all-girls summer camp I went to. And basically, I would just rush into the dining hall because I knew he was working to clear the dishes, and I'd try to be the first to arrive to catch his attention, and then I would clear not just the plates from my table, but I would try to clear as many tables as I could just so I could run back and forth and grab his attention as he was cleaning the dishes. And it was really, I thought I was being subtle, but I've learned in retrospect that I was nothing of the sort, and I probably totally humiliated myself. But nonetheless, I was quite persistent, and we ultimately became friendly, but nothing more than that. I think he was more interested in some of the older girls than me.
Well, tell us about Mr. 11.
Mr. 11 was really the guy who had his locker next to mine in high school, and a friend of mine and I gave him the nickname Mr. 11 because we thought he was one hotter than a 10. And the whole school year, I was so paralyzed with insecurity, I could barely talk to him. And his locker was right next to mine. So I just would take vicarious pleasure in being close enough to actually, you know, get a whiff of him or kind of see what kind of classes he was taking from the books or what he brought for lunch. But honestly, Pamela, I did not have the courage to even dialogue with him, which is kind of sad, but true.
It's kind of sad, but it is very often true, particularly when someone is the object of your crush. And that's yeah. And it feels like it's a one-way crush. It's really hard to talk to that person.
Yes, it is. And, you know, the idea of anything being reciprocal was just beyond me. I mean, I truly felt that my crushes were just even the ones that were human, you know, like in the flesh, not just movie stars or singers, that they just would never in a million years take an interest in me. So I think that I knew the crushes weren't attainable, which is one of the reasons why I don't think I actually advocated for myself. I had no belief that any of these people would actually be interested in me. It was a truly based on longing. And I came to feel very comfortable. As painful as the longing could be, it became a habit for me. It became a way of giving myself some sustenance through this fantasy life, but ultimately, as I'm sure you can appreciate, it's not ultimately fulfilling. But I didn't think I was worthy of actually receiving some boy's attention, so I didn't even go for it. And that's kind of sad to look back on, but it's true.
You talk about the fact that for you, being loved was a matter of how much work you could accomplish in the service of that love.
Exactly. I was a really classic people pleaser, somebody who kind of habitually behaved in ways that I thought would please others and would get me love. But all it got me was approval, and it becomes like a hamster wheel of needing to continue to perfect, to please, to perform, to get this really, what I see now as a substitute for real love, as is just approval. And so that became a habit I developed as a child and continued into my adult years and brought that even into my marriage. I married a man with two beautiful children, and for the first year and a half, perhaps, I think I was just still working to people please. I was doing more chores around the house than the other three people in my house combined. I felt like at any moment I could kind of get voted off the island of my family if I weren't constantly pleasing. And that's not a good place to parent. It's not a good place to be in a marriage from, that place of diminishment and inferiority and, frankly, fear. You know, there's a sense if I'm not, quote unquote, enough, that I'll lose these important people to me. And when a relationship's not based on two equals, we're going to have problems, and eventually resentment, for example, is one of them.
You talk about your pattern of dating men who were unavailable. And so, of course, if you're dating somebody who's unavailable, you could work your fingers to the bone, literally, and that person's still going to be unavailable, not because of any work you do or don't do, but just because of their lack of emotional connectedness. What was that like for you as an adult? You talk about having had affairs with men who just weren't available to you.
That's right. That was incredibly painful, incredibly painful. And it was through my work that I began to realize how much I was contributing to this dynamic. So I would lament the fact that there were no quote-unquote good men, while I would be choosing men who didn't have the goods, and not taking responsibility for that, or believing that I could reform them or rehabilitate them or be enough so that they would become available. And it was a dance, and it was a delusion, and it was so unconstructive and painful. And I'm not proud of some of the choices I made. I regret completely, and they came from a real place of unworthiness and unwholesomeness within me. And I was grasping that the painful truth of it, Pamela, was I didn't believe I was worthy of receiving. So I seemed to attract unavailable men who would take and take and take because I didn't believe that the ones who were available, that I could receive when they did show up with attentiveness. I played these games on all my dates where I would make sure that I would ask them questions and not let them get a word in edgewise in terms of about me, you know, and I would set them up basically. And then I would say, well, he's not interested in me. He can only think about himself. Meanwhile, I just created a scenario where all I did was pepper him with questions about himself. And it was very unflattering, but I'm being really honest, which I am throughout the book, because I think it's important, because I know I'm not alone. I know a lot of women do things to distance themselves from the intimacy they say they seek. And so my attracting unavailable men into my life was my issue.
And you're right, it is an issue that affects many people, men as well as women. But I certainly hear about it very often with women, sadly.
Yes.
The unavailability of the men, in some ways, you know, your dad was not really available. He was home, but not really. You said he was working and then some. So you know, in some ways you were dating what you knew and who you knew. Speaking of unavailable men, I want to shift now to your experiences in therapy. There was a time when you and your husband were working in therapy, and then the decision was made that you would seek therapy on your own. What was that decision about?
It was after my mom had died. My husband and I had started to see a couples counselor because there were a lot of issues relative to a second marriage for him, first marriage for me, and just to blending our family. So we were really just working with the therapist. And then when my mom died, that created such a stress for me that we decided I needed my own time as a therapist. And so we decided that I would see this therapist independently of the couples counseling. And that's what happened. And basically what you said a moment ago, Pamela, was so true. All I knew from my childhood was how to be tuned in to unavailable men. Well, there's very few men less available than one's therapist if they're professional. And thank goodness I had a very professional therapist. So it didn't take long in my vulnerable state of grief. I mean, it was grief. It was bereavement. I was topsy-turvy. And to have this man give me his undivided attention, I couldn't play my tricks of asking him about himself that I did with all my previous boyfriends or in my dating life. His job was to ask me questions and look at me. And it was incredibly seductive, even though, again, 100% professional behavior on his part, just asking questions, being a tuned-in listener. But I fell head over heels in love, or something like it, which is an experience. Clinically, it's called transference, and I'm not the only person this happens to in therapy. In fact, many professionals in psychology will tell you it's the crux of good therapy. It's not always a romantic transference, but often what happens in therapy, as I'm sure you and many of your listeners know, is that there is a transference from the patient to the therapist of some dynamic from childhood, and that's what then becomes the crux of the therapy, is to kind of look at that in a safe environment, and that did unfold. But it was a rocky, challenging, painful journey, as I'm sure you know since you've read the book.
The notion of some of the things that you tried to gift your therapist with, because again, that's what happens when you believe that the way for you to be quote unquote loved and accepted is for you to work and work and work. Gift giving is not unusual. One of the gifts you wanted to give your therapist was to remodel the entrance to the clinic.
Yes, I wanted to redecorate the common areas in the clinic that he worked. I wanted to decorate it in a way that I felt was more special and aligned with the value of what happened in those offices and his bathroom, the bathroom and the waiting area and the stairwell. I offered to paint it, to get new furniture, and I put a 3-page proposal together, and I thought, how can he resist? It was going to be my time and my dime. And I can't tell you how stunned I was when he said, "Cheryl, I don't think there's anyone in the world who would be as good at this as you, and I can't take you up on it, and because that would be a gift." And I was crestfallen and undaunted, and I continued to try to find things that I could give to him that he would accept, and it never worked. It never worked. And you're so right. It was my attempt at earning my place with him. I mean, here's a person I was already paying, mind you, and yet it didn't feel enough. I felt I had to bring him cookies. I had to bring him tickets to a ball game, gardenias, you name it. I wanted to do it. In fact, I even developed this very kind of extreme fantasy that one day he would be in peril and he would need an organ, maybe a kidney, and I could give him one of my kidneys. I mean, that's how kind of desperate, honestly, I felt to give him something so that he would care for me, even though he already did care for me and I wouldn't really even receive that. So this was a really perilous dynamic for me. It was not serving me, but the gift of therapy was we could look at it more objectively. As painful as it was, I needed to be confronted with what was going on for me that I couldn't just receive from this professional who I was already paying, how hard it was just to be seen and heard, and that I had value even if I didn't give him cookies. And that took a long time, Pamela, to really get through my head that I'm worthy and whole just because I'm me, just because I exist. I don't have to earn it, especially with men. I don't have to earn it. That was one of the biggest lessons of my life. Hard-won lesson, as most of the good ones are.
You spent time really thinking about him, fantasizing about him, planning what your outfits were going to be when you went into therapy. This had to have had an impact on your marriage. How did it impact your marriage?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I wasn't sharing this part at that time of my experience in therapy. Of course, my husband knew I was seeing this therapist, but he had no idea of this crush. I mean, how could I tell him? I felt guilty as passionately as this fantasy life was. I felt incredibly guilty about it, and I didn't want to hurt my husband. And again, nothing was happening in the physical realm. These feelings were not being reciprocated. Again, I feel so grateful because I know not every woman has, or man has, such professionals working with them who are good at keeping boundaries, but mine was. And so nothing was quote-unquote happening, so I thought I didn't really have to say anything to my husband. I didn't think of it as an affair. I just thought it was part of what my life of crushing on men, what I knew so well. It wasn't until I was writing the book and knew that I was going to be including this that I needed to talk to my husband about it. And it was difficult. It was so difficult, understandably. And I absolutely put myself in his position and tried to think, wow, you know, what would it be like if we were having the opposite conversation? It would be hard, for sure. Luckily, you know, at that point, we were seeing a separate couples counselor, and she did a masterful job at really helping my husband to see how much this had to do with a clinical process and that it wasn't an affair. And in fact, that it was a very smart way for me to deal with my feelings rather than have a traditional affair, if there is such a thing, that I worked it through in this way. And the one thing she said that really helped him was she said, if my husband were my therapist and the therapist were my husband, this still would have happened, really meaning that it was about the dynamic, that in some ways therapy was set up for this. It was not about my husband, and it wasn't even about the therapist as a person, because frankly, I didn't even know the therapist outside of those hours we spent together. So I hope that makes some sense. But it was a challenge, Pamela. And it ultimately served us because it was a huge gateway towards intimacy with my husband once I did share this with him. And then, of course, it kind of demystified and took some of the air out of the crush just by telling him about it. And so it was a growthful step for us, and I give my husband tremendous credit. I think that takes so much kind of ego strength and love. My husband is not kind of psychologically oriented as I am, and so for him this was a real stretch, and I give him a lot of credit. I think he came from a place of love to try to work through this with me.
And the ongoing fears that you had for so long of if you didn't perform well enough, you were going to essentially be thrown away, fired, if you will. I just can't imagine that fear in connection with actually telling your husband what you had not told him before about your crush with the therapist.
Yeah, that's again, very, very astute. And it was, that's why I did it actually in the couples counseling office, because I was terrified that he would throw me out of our marriage. But I know he loves me, and he wanted to get it. And so, it, as I said, it was a great gift he gave me. I mean, he has been such a champion. Sometimes I joke he sells more of my books than I do. I think his journey is one that's laudable, because he had to, you know, deal with a woman going public about her crush on her therapist in very vivid detail, as you see. And that takes a lot. So kudos to him. And you're right. It tested my fear of being thrown out, and it helped break the dynamic. I mean, then I got to see, you know, there's room in my marriage for me to have all of my experience, including a crush on the therapist. And that makes the marriage bigger and better, ultimately.
Speaking of some of the fears that you had, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, you had so many things that you were afraid of that, in fact, you say there was no room in my childhood for me. There was plenty of room for fear and shame. When we come back, I'd like to pick up there. Cheryl, in writing Where Have I Been All My Life? A Journey Toward Love and Wholeness, you talk about the things that brought you fear and shame, and there were so many. You were afraid of making a mess. You were afraid of being rejected. You were afraid of being fat, afraid of leaving home, afraid of staying at home. It's almost unimaginable to have so many fears and still get up and do whatever you were going to do each day.
Yeah, when you put it like that, it is amazing. I think the common denominator, frankly, was anxiety, which my guess is a lot of your listeners can relate to. I think I was a really anxious kid. I was really afraid of losing the approval / love of my parents. I did not have what's called clinically a secure base. I didn't have it in my home, and I didn't have it in myself. I did not have a kind of a true sense of belonging to myself. And you're right, it made things that for other children are quite easy, like going on play dates now, we call them, there were sleepovers, incredibly challenging. The separation anxiety I felt was staggering. I couldn't complete my first year of kindergarten. I had to come home and try again the next year. Mess. My father had a hard time kind of tolerating anything messy or chaotic. Even play, which can be messy, was not something that was comfortable in my home. And consequently, again, I was kind of parentified early on. Even when other kids were playing on the street, I would be by my mom's side, kind of listening to the adults talk. And I think that's one of the reasons I adore working with women and listening to them talk now, is because I was so acculturated to that at a young age. And then, of course, the food, food was a big part of it in my appearance and being able to be acceptable in terms of how I looked. And I often felt unacceptable, to put it lightly. So you're right, there were many kind of day-to-day ways of just expressing our humanity as children that for me were incredibly fraught. And it is sad. And I had a period of time where I would develop hives all over my body. And we're not talking little dots of hives. We're talking full-blown, the size of Canada, on every part of my body, raised hives. And the doctor said there was no known reason for them. And so I think that was my body's way of trying to navigate this terrain. And unfortunately, I didn't have many options at that time. But you know what? Everything serves us. So I got through, and I think it did teach me a lot about being sensitive. And so I have tremendous compassion and empathy that I think serves me professionally and personally now.
Everything is a lesson. You learn something from every experience is really true, and something that perhaps more of us could stand to recognize, even those lessons that you don't want to learn, even those experiences that you wished you never had, they do in fact teach us.
Absolutely. Sometimes they're our greatest teachers. In fact, I believe, like, just principally, that's one of the hallmarks of resilience, is really being able to make meaning from everything that happens in your life. And if you make meaning from everything, especially the hardships, you can't lose. There's no such thing as failure. Making meaning from our life experiences. You know, Viktor Frankl talks about it so exquisitely, beautifully in Man's Search for Meaning, about the people he lived through the Holocaust with. He said those who survived weren't necessarily the strongest physically. They were those who found something to live for, who had created meaning for themselves. And I know that's a very exaggerated, stark, kind of horrific example. And yet, I think it permeates all of our lives, whatever life gives us. If we can make it count, make meaning from our suffering, we win.
I'm going to share a quote with the audience. It's something that you said that let me just read it. You said, "I see my young self tucked tightly into a straitjacket of neatness, kindness, and pleasing. There was no room for hunger of any kind, no room for anger, for joy, for play, for me." And how many children do we know, do we see, that are indeed tucked into that straitjacket of neatness and kindness and pleasing? And so clearly what you're talking about, what you experienced, was at the extreme end. There's a balance. There's nothing wrong with, and there's everything right with, teaching children about neatness, kindness, and pleasing, but not in the extreme, so much so that the child disappears.
Exactly. That's so well said. Not in the extreme. That's why it took me a while to really unpack this, Pamela, because I would even defend in therapy, what's wrong with being taught to be kind, with being neat, with being sensitive to other people? These are laudable characteristics, and yet, taken to the extreme, they're not. Anything that we develop a rigidity around doesn't serve us. There's the shadow side. It's not always good to be kind. There are times when one needs to assert oneself and be kind to oneself. It's not always good to be neat. There are times in creation where creativity is messy. So anything that's taken to an extreme is actually not helpful. And that straitjacket has to come off, and we need to have permission to have the full range of human experiences. Certainly experiences, how we act on them, you know, is certainly worth, you know, thinking about. Just because we feel angry doesn't mean we throw a chair across the room. But the legitimacy of it's okay to be angry if your brother steals your toy or what have you. Not just to be nice because he's your little brother. I mean, this is the kind of thing subtly that erodes one's sense of wholeness. And at least in my experience, that's what happened to me.
So you learn how to be truly quiet about what's true for you.
Right. And for a while, didn't see anything wrong with it because that's how I got praised, by being good. So it was like feeding the meter. I knew that I was valued. I felt important in my family because I was the good one. Goodness knows what I did to my brother because he didn't have that avenue. I had the corner on being kind and sweet and a good girl. And I think, you know, he'll have to write his book one day. But that, I'm sure, I know, cost him in other ways. There was only one way to go, and good's already taken. So, yeah, it was diminishing and stifling in many ways.
You know, I think you just made an important observation, though, for parents. There's only one way to go when good is already taken. You know, so many times parents will, unfortunately, compare one child with the other. He's so good, you're so terrible. And that has devastating impact on the entire family system, but certainly on the folks who are being compared.
Exactly. And instead of being able to give each child permission to experience their full array of emotions and not to be stuck in one role to be convenient or to please the parents. And because children want to be distinct, and of course they are, but they certainly crave to find their place. And every child struggles in their own way to find their place. Where do I belong in this family? And will contort themselves in whatever way, whether it's being funny, whether it's being angry, whether it's being good. Everybody looks for their way of belonging in the system. And that's just the way it is. And it's coming to kind of appreciate that. And this is something that's so important, that we all do what we need to do to kind of survive. And that's good. You know, we come by this stuff honestly. And I think the path to wholeness in adulthood is realizing how these behaviors, these adaptations, if you will, served us. And then when they don't, when they no longer serve us and we need to let them go or create a balance. And that's the work that most of us do, if we're lucky, in adulthood. And sometimes, as it did for me, Pamela, it takes a loss as big as and seismic as losing my mom when I wasn't ready to really propel me to do that work. And that's where I'm incredibly grateful, because had she lived another 20 years, I don't know if I would have done this work until she passed. So, again, you know, there's a Buddhist saying, I think it's Buddhist, good, bad, who knows. Her loss was devastating to me, and a lot of good has come from it.
Were there things that you learned about yourself during the course of writing Where Have I Been All My Life?
Yes, and a lot. And one of the biggest things I learned about myself was that I was able to disappoint people I loved. In writing a memoir, an honest one, it takes a lot of courage. And in my case, I'm the people pleaser, right? So I wrote things in this book that people close to me were not pleased about. And I had to risk their disapproval, whether it be my husband's or my father's, to name two, and not capitulate. So I learned that I can use my voice even when it causes people I love so much pain. That was one of the biggest things I learned about myself, from doing this, writing the book.
The relationship with your dad, how was that impacted by the writing of the book?
Yeah, it was challenged. It was challenged. I won't go into it too much because I don't want to speak for him. I can just say that it was a very painful experience for him and between us. And he always supported me writing my story. In theory, I think when it came to what I actually wrote and my experience, I think that was very, very difficult for him, and it was very bumpy for us. And I'm happy to say that we're in a really good place now, and it took some work to get there.
But it certainly sounds like it was work well done and well deserved for both of you.
Exactly. I feel like my father knows me now, not just as his good, sweet daughter, but as a woman. He knows me as a woman, and we can agree to disagree. Memory's not perfect. And I say, you know, that's why this is a memoir and it's not an autobiography. And there's a big difference. Memoir is, you know, it's truthful, true to my experience. But, you know, he could look at the same experience and interpret it differently. And as I say, you know, everybody's able to write their own book. But this is my experience, my truth of my lived experience and what I've done with it. And it's a work of art, and I think he's come to appreciate that. But you're right, us working through that has been a gift to both of us, because now I feel like my father sees me as an adult woman, and I've kind of broken out of that, the mold that honestly didn't serve either of us. He's not perfect, and I had to grieve that, and I'm not perfect, and he had to grieve that. And that's powerful, Pamela.
It is exceptionally powerful, and work that in so many ways we all need to do and very often don't find a way to get there. The reality that your parents aren't perfect, that you're not perfect, that you use the word grief, and in fact, it really is a grieving process. Tell us about Voice Your Vision. What is that?
Your Voice Your Vision is my business. So I help women be leaders in their own lives, and I do that through coaching leaders in corporations and coaching people privately who are up to something big and juicy in their life, and they want help. They're making a transition, whether it be personal or professional. I have a background in applied positive psychology, so I use a lot of the methods and tools from positive psychology to help people flourish. And I also speak to women. I have a seminar from Inner Critic to Inner Champion, and that really helps women turn down the volume on their inner critic, which you know I know a lot about, and helps them develop a relationship with their inner champion, which is an abiding voice of wisdom that I believe all women have inside of them, but they just don't necessarily know it. So that's really my passion now, Pamela, is helping women to discover their voice, claim their voice in service of their vision for their lives, and that's my business.
And you have a website for that business.
I do. It's yourvoiceyourvision.com. All one word, yourvoiceyourvision.com. It's so kind of you to ask.
Tell us about your You Matter project. What's that?
Oh, thanks for asking, Pamela. This is a hoot. This is a You Matter marathon. No running required before we lose all your listeners. This is really a race of the heartstrings where I invite people to give out one card that only has the words You Matter on it a day during the month of November. And last year we gave out almost 500,000 cards. This year we're on track for 1,000,000 cards. And I mail 30 You Matter cards for free to the first about 3,000 people who sign up at youmattermarathon.com. And we have a Facebook page as well. And Pamela, this has been one of the best gifts of my life to give this to the world, because as you know, this quest for mattering matters. And so many people don't feel that they matter, as I questioned in my life. And so now I help women professionally honor that they do matter. But what I found is that in telling somebody else that they matter, we enhance our own sense of significance. So giving out these You Matter cards has become an incredible happy habit of mine, and inviting other people to join me in it has really been life-changing. I mean, just, again, go to the Facebook page or the website, and you'll see story after story of people's experiences giving out these simple cards with a profound impact. And that's youmattermarathon.com.
Are there any particular experiences, one, that you can share with us as a result of the You Matter Marathon?
Sure. One that comes to mind from somebody who participated last year, an adult woman whose adult son she was estranged from. He had his own set of problems and was actually just released from jail, and she was trying to reestablish a relationship with him. He was in a halfway house, and they met. And she said the first thing she did was give him a You Matter card, and he started to cry. And this had been their first connection in years. And she said she really felt that it was a gateway to reestablishing a relationship with him. And he, in fact, asked her for cards that he could give to people living in this halfway house. And I thought to myself, and she wrote a beautiful letter, much more eloquent than I'm describing it. And I thought to myself, if this was the only reason we did the You Matter Marathon last year, it would have been worth it. And we have story after story, and it's all over the world. We have pharmacists in New Zealand putting these cards, You Matter cards, into the prescriptions that they fill for people, for the spouses of people who are in hospice, Pamela. So when these spouses come to pick up their prescription for their loved one, they get a You Matter card. And we know that caregivers are sometimes undervalued in this country. And so that's what's happening in New Zealand. We have school districts participating. It just goes on and on and on. The power of just even one card share is really incalculable.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And just quickly before we run out of time, the ways that people can be in touch with you, the websites.
The website is Your Voice, Your Vision is my professional website. And then youmattermarathon.com. If someone just wants to send me an email, my email is Cheryl Rice. One word, Cheryl Rice at Comcast.net. But I'm accessible on both those websites, Pamela.
Terrific. Thank you, Cheryl, so much for the work that you are doing and for sharing time with us today.
Pamela, it's truly been a privilege. You matter.
Thank you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk comes to you daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And you can download Mind Talk at the Mind Talk programs at mindtalk.org, MYNDTALK. .org, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes or Google Play stores. And remember, always, if it's unacceptable, then that is what it is. You take care.